Kyle Willoughby. Joining me is Claire White.
Hi.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a nerd manual. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. Today we are talking about A Court of Thorns and Roses, written by Sarah J. Maas. It's a young adult fantasy novel. It was released in May of 2015. The next installment in this trilogy, A Court of Thorns and Roses trilogy, is called A Court of Mist and Fury, and that came out on May 3rd of this year, 2016. In this podcast, we'll be talking about the first book in the trilogy, A Court of Thorns and Roses. And I will be discussing the different myths and fairy tales that that first book drew upon. It's loosely based off of Beauty and the Beast, but there's some other myths and fairy tales in there that she kind of pulls from.
So I'm going to talk about a little bit about the production of the book, but I'm mostly going to talk about YA literature and how it got to where it is today.
That sounds great. I'm really curious about that, actually, because YA seems like such a big thing now, and it seems pretty new.
Yeah, it is.
All right, let's do it. Let's talk about Beauty and the Beast, which this book, A Court of Thorns and Roses, is loosely based off of. So, Beauty and the Beast, the story, was originally written in 1740 by a woman named Gabriella Suzanne Barbeau de Villeneuve. And there's a lot of French names I'm going to be messing up, so you'll have to pardon me.
I don't know if I can do that.
French names, yeah. There's a lot of French names and one Latin name that I will be butchering today.
We've counted.
Yeah. So Gabriella, who we're on a first name basis, me and Gabriella, she wrote this book in the mid-18th century, so 1740, and it was more for adults. It wasn't the child's fairy tale that, you know, you tell to your daughter at night. It was for adults, first of all, that dealt with issues like rape and forced marriage. And Gabriella was a minor noble and the horrible issue of women having to work and men having to work manual labor.
Wow. This is Beauty and the Beast.
This is Beauty and the Beast, yeah. And she was not down with women working or she didn't like it. It was a bad place to be. If you're a woman working, your life sucks. According to Gabriella, my girl.
Now, you agree?
Well, I mean, I don't know.
You're not a woman, so you can't quite say.
Yeah,
but
I can't quite say. This is true. So her story was longer than the Beauty and Beast tale we know. Her story doesn't end when Beauty and the Beast fall in love because he turns into a hot prince.
They don't live happily ever after?
Well, they do, but it goes on and on and on. It rambles, kind of. And you hear more about her backstory and the Beast's backstory, and it gets a little funky. So it's different than the Beauty and the Beast we know. But I'm going to give an overview of her story, of the original written story. So there's this wealthy merchant who's got a bunch of goods. He puts them on three ships, sends them out to sea to make a ton of money. Those three ships are never heard of. They're presumed gone. Family gets really, really poor, has to move into a tiny cottage in the country. Merchant's got six sons and six daughters. They all hate that they're poor. They blame their father a lot. The only one who is cool with it and looks at the sunny side is the youngest daughter, Belle.
Okay.
And her siblings kind of hate her for it. So one of these days, the merchant gets a message that one of your ships came back out of the blue. It's back at port. You know, you have some money. So the merchant tells his kids. Kids are ecstatic. They're like, look, you got to bring back. We're going to be rich again. Bring us all back presents. I want gold and jewels. And the girls want nice dresses. And the merchant asks Belle what Belle wants. And Belle says, I just want you to return healthy. And the merchant's like, no, I bring you back something. What do you want? And she's like, well, bring me back a rose. It's wintertime and I love roses. Bring me back a rose. So the merchant's like, okay, done deal. So the merchant leaves his family, travels through the woods to the town, gets to a ship, finds that it has been seized by creditors, people who he owed money to, and all the profits have already been diced up, and he doesn't get anything. It's paying all his debts, essentially.
Mm.
Yeah, sucks for the merchant. So he's very upset. He's got to go back to his kids empty-handed, and so he's returning all mopey through the woods, gets lost in the snow and the wind.
It's winter.
And stumbles onto a manor that is warm and it feels like springtime, this whole estate. And he's like, wow, what is this? He walks up to the castle on this manor and sees that the door's open, kind of walks in. He's kind of looking for people, being like, hello, is anyone home? No one's home. He goes inside. He sees there's a big chair and a fire and a feast laid out. So he sits down. He eats some food, wondering what's going on.
I feel like that would be something they would tell you not to
do. Not to do, right? You just wander into a stranger's house and eat their food. But he does, and he wanders around, eats the food, goes out into the garden, and sees this amazing rose on this rose bush, a beautiful rose. And he's like, well, if I can't get anything for any of my other kids, at least I can get Belle her gift. Goes up, picks the rose. All of a sudden, a terrifying beast appears, angry as all hell. And he says, "How this is my manor. How could you take my rose? It's the one thing I care about in all the world, or it's the thing I care most about. I let you into my house, sit in my chair. I gave you food." And the merchant is very confused. He's like, "Whoa, I don't know what's going on." He immediately grovels and starts apologizing.
I think that's what you got to do.
That's what you got to do when a big scary beast appears.
That's what I would do.
And the beast says, "All right, well, I have to kill you. You took the rose. I have to kill you."
Whoa.
And the merchant's like, whoa, we can make a deal. I'm a merchant, please. And so the beast is like, okay, well, I know I'm going to kill you. And the merchant's like, please, the only reason I took this rose is because my daughter really wanted it, and I was supposed to come back with all these gifts, and I have nothing. And the beast is like, okay, I'll cut a deal with you then. So I need to have someone's life. You need to either stay here with me forever, or you can go back home, tell your daughters about this, and get one of them under their own volition to come out here and stay here forever. And the merchant's like, man, that sucks, but I guess I'll do it. So the merchant goes home. His kids are bummed that they didn't get any cool presents. Tells the family about what happened. The kids hate on Belle even more because they blame her. They're like, if you didn't need that rose, none of this would have ever happened. And Belle accepts responsibility. She's like, I guess it's my fault. You're right. I will go.
Of course she does.
She does, because she's like the nice one. She's the good one. And she says, I'll go live with this beast. And the father isn't happy about it, but he also doesn't want to be stuck there forever. So the father takes Belle back, and Belle meets the beast, and Beast's like, you're here on your own volition. Belle's like, yes. So Belle starts living there with the beast. And at first she's terrified of him, but over time they kind of grow, and they talk to each other a lot. And every night in this original story, every night before bed, the beast asks, come to bed with me. A little forward, if you ask me.
Yeah.
I wouldn't lead with that line. So the beast always is a little grumpy that she says no to him. And she goes to bed. And when she goes to bed, she dreams of this handsome prince saying, like, you need to help me, please. I'm trapped here. Help. And she starts to think that maybe this beast has this prince imprisoned somewhere. But I think we know where the story's going.
In his heart.
In his heart, yes. So eventually Belle and the Beast get a rapport, and Belle gets homesick and says, hey, Beast, if you could, please, I'd like to go home and visit my family. I promise I'll come back. The Beast says, I've really fallen in love with you over time, and it's going to kill me to let you go, but I know you're homesick, so you can go home for 2 months. Just you can't be gone a day longer than 2 months, or I'll die. And she's like, okay, cool. And upon leaving, Belle is given from the Beast a ring that she can turn 3 times and it'll transport her back to the manor, and a golden mirror and that she can look at to see the Beast in the manor while
she's
gone.
Kind of like the Disney movie.
A lot like the Disney movie, actually, yes. So I'd forgotten to mention this before, but when Belle was dropped off at the Beast's castle by her father, the Beast had given her father a ton of money, like all this golden stuff and magic chests that never seemed to be full, and he'd gone off with the money. So Belle goes back home and finds that her family has squandered all this money. They're poor again.
Even without her, they were still
even
poor.
Even without her, they still could not get their stuff together. And her siblings, who didn't like her to begin with, see that she's living this awesome life, that she's like wearing nice clothes, and they thought the Beast was going to eat her. And she's like, no, he's actually a okay guy. And so they're jealous, and they know that she's only supposed to stay with them for 2 months. So her sisters rub onion in their eyes to make it seem like they're crying when it's time for her to leave. And she feels bad, so she's like, okay, I'll stay one more day. She stays one more day. She has a dream where a woman is telling her, like, look, hey, the Beast is in trouble. You need to get back to the castle immediately. She wakes up, feels guilty again. Belle feels guilty nonstop in the story.
She's a good Catholic.
She's a good Catholic girl. She turns her magic ring to get her back to the manor. And she finds the Beast on the verge of death lying in front of the rose bush. And she runs up to him upset and cries and says, I love you. Please don't die. Cries on him. And at this point, he's magically just resurrected. He's like, I feel fine again. And he's like, you love me. I love you too. We should get married. Now, in this story, in the original story, he doesn't turn into a prince until after their wedding night. So they have their wedding night and she wakes up in the morning and he's a hot prince.
That is a lesson.
One night with a hairy dude.
And he turns into a prince.
And he'll turn into a hot prince.
I'll have to keep that in mind.
And yeah, keep that in mind. And Gabriella's Beauty and the Beast goes on. It doesn't end there. It goes on and on and on, and you hear more about the backstory of the Beast and of Belle's family, and you find out that Belle isn't even actually the daughter of a merchant. But we don't have to get into that. So that was the original version written in 1740. Now, it was rewritten in 1756, only 16 years later, an abridged version by another French woman whose name I'm going to butcher, Jeannette Marie Le Prince de Beaumont.
Sans copyright.
Yeah, right? You'd think that happened today, it would be much more of a fight. But her version was very short. They cut down the number of kids that the merchant had. You know, Belle had two sisters and three brothers. And it was more for kids. The whole second half of the book where you find out about the Beast and Belle's backstory, that's taken out. The book ends when the Beast and Belle, you know, when Belle cries on the Beast, and right then he transforms into a sexy prince. Right immediately. You don't have to do the one night with the Beast.
You get him right there.
You get him right there.
It's and like Disney.
It's like Disney. And instead of the Beast asking her to come to bed with him every night, he asks her to marry him every night.
Like Disney.
Like Disney. It was more for kids, you know, and it was a moral tale. It was like, don't judge a book by its cover.
Okay.
So, and that's the most popular version of Beauty and the Beast. That's the story that we know, is the abridged one by Jeannette. So there are a ton of similarities and things from A Court of Thorns and Roses that are directly the same as in both of these fairy tales, the Gabriella and Jeannette ones, either of them.
Yeah?
So, yeah. Yeah.
Do tell.
You know, the main character in A Court of Thorns and Roses is Feyre, and Feyre is the old English word for fair. It means fair one, so like a fair lady.
Beauty.
So beauty. She has a merchant father who lost three ships
at sea,
and that's why they're broke, and they live in a cottage. She has two older sisters who are not happy with their situation and are useless. Like, Feyre takes care of the whole family, essentially. She's, like, the only nice one. It's eternal spring at the manor that she's taken to, at Tamlin's Manor, who's the main dude in the book, the Beast. Feyre's love is required to break the spell that's, you know, on Tamlin and his manor and his people. And also in A Court of Thorns and Roses, Tamlin sends money and pays out her family, because it's one thing in the book, Feyre's constantly worried that her family is starving without her because she was the only one who could do anything. But then Tamlin's like, no, it's fine. I sent him a bunch of cash. They're totally good. So there's one other legend that I really wanted to talk about, and it's a Scottish fairy tale, and it's the legend of Tamlin.
Oh,
yes.
I see.
Yes. So the main male character in this book is taken straight out of a Scottish fairy tale. He's a human man who's captured by a fairy queen, and he falls in love with a girl, and the girl has to save him from the clutches of the fairy queen.
Sounds familiar.
It does sound a little familiar. A lot happens. They meet in the woods, is where Tamlin, and it's normally Janet is normally the name of, or Margaret is normally the name of the female protagonist. They meet in the woods, they fall in love, and she has to save him from the captivity of an elf queen.
Okay.
And that's a fairy tale that dates back to at least 1549, but probably earlier.
Whoa. There's no new tales.
No, everything under the sun has been told. Isn't that what they say?
That's what they say.
I'm curious about tales of young adult.
Well, they're not.
Market capital.
Not quite as dramatic. But I'll see what I can do. There's no I love you and then you get a handsome prince.
No, nothing like that.
There's a lot like that in the books, but all right. So as far as the production of this book goes, you've mentioned a lot of it. She talks about the myths that influenced her. She talks about being inspired a lot by music and that she uses that to write the stories. She also talks about a lot of the fantasy that she's really into, Lord of the Rings. She mentions Terry Goodkind books.
Sort of truth novels, yeah.
Yeah, she's a real nerd. I really liked her when I was reading the interviews. And there's no great drama about how she got this published because she already had a very successful other series, Throne of Glass series, that had been published. So what I found really interesting, actually, was the YA genre. It's not a genre. I was almost said YA genre.
YA is not a genre.
No, YA literature, YA fiction, because it is. It's so big right now.
Yeah.
So I'm going to kind of go into the history of that and how it got to where it is today, and then I'll talk about it right now and some of the tropes that are used.
In those books, okay.
Yeah. So I'm going to start that after World War II, teens were given their own demographic. You are no longer children, but you are not adults. You are teens. In 1942, Maureen Daly wrote the first book exclusively for teens. It's called The 17th Summer, and it's about falling in love for the first time. It's for young girls. Now, it's not YA yet because YA doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And you could actually say that there are other books that could be YA that have been written. Great Expectations, Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah, Catcher in the Rye is
for YA, for young adults.
Age, yeah.
Lord of the Flies.
Okay.
Treasure Island.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Little Women, yeah. Little House on the Prairie. These are all books that are for teens, but they were never marketed for teens. They're more marketed for children or adults. There's this gray area.
Kind of gray line.
Yeah, that publishers don't really market anything towards them.
Yeah.
So in the 60s, the Young Adult Library Services coined the phrase young adult.
Okay.
So that's where YA young adult comes from.
In the 60s.
In the 60s. So in 1962, another one of the first YA books came out, and this is one that wasn't sugar-coated, wasn't sweet. It's The Outsiders by S.E. Hinton.
Love that book.
Yeah, most people had to read it.
Yeah, I read it
in
school.
I didn't have to read it. I read about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But so this, and then after that in the 70s, Judy Blume is coming out with books.
Judy Blume.
Yes. Her biggest being Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. There's The Chocolate War by Robert Cormier. And these herald in a golden age of young adult literature.
Gotcha.
And it goes into the 80s. And in the 80s, people maybe think the quality wasn't as good, but they introduce YA franchises. You get R.L. Stein books. You get the Sweet Valley High books.
Okay.
In the 1990s, YA literature dipped.
Uh-oh.
Now, I know. Uh-oh. Now, you could argue that there's less teens because of lower birth rates.
Oh, so there were less readers of YA
literature. Right, less readers. That could be part of it.
Yeah.
But actually, there was a bit of a national crisis. Because in 2004, the National Endowment for the Arts published a study that said that the number of literature readers, young adults reading literature, dropped 20% between 1982 and 2002, which was the greatest loss of young readership the country had ever recorded.
Yeah, that's down a percent every year. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
Yeah.
So there was panic, there were incentive programs all around the country, and good news. In 2009, the National Endowment for the Arts reported that there was a 21% increase from 2002 when they first published that study.
Okay, so 2002 to 2009, readership went up 21%.
21%.
That's pretty good.
Now, do you think all these incentive programs, that's what did it, right?
There's a book series that came out in that time frame that I think may have had a big effect.
Maybe.
On this.
So... In 1997, a little book called Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone came out.
Yeah, did it.
Yeah. Now, it wasn't very popular right away, but in 2004, the fifth book, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, came out and sold 5 million copies in the first 24 hours.
Yeah, that was really like a, you know, boulder rolling down the hill, just getting bigger and bigger. It was a snowball.
Right. And all of a sudden... young adults were reading again. Now, I mean, the incentive programs in America might have helped,
yeah.
But I think Harry Potter
J.K.
has something
Rowling,
to do with it, too.
Our incentive program from across the sea.
Yes. And she is given a lot of credit for heralding in the second golden age of young adult literature.
Which is totally where we are now.
Exactly. So Twilight, The Hunger Games, all Divergent, all of these are part of this.
Yeah, the new young adult
explosion.
Yeah,
because publishers saw how much money could be made from Harry Potter.
Yeah, because you know what? Not just young adults want to read young adult books.
Right. And I was looking at some stats. So in 1997, 3,000 young adult books were published. In 2009, over 30,000 young adult books were published. So
people knew.
Yes, more people are reading, but publishers, because they see the worth in it, are also putting out more options. In 2014, it was reported that book sales for young adult novels increased 22.4%, while adult fiction and nonfiction increased 3.3%. So it's an ever-growing readership.
Yeah, that's cool that it's increasing. Both the nonfiction, adult nonfiction, and fiction are increasing.
Yeah.
Just young adult.
Well, book sales increased overall.
Yeah.
But that's cool. Young adult is what increased the most.
By a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. What's also interesting is that they think about 55% of young adult novels are bought by adults.
I know a lot of people close to me who are embarrassed to say that they read a ton of young adult.
A lot of my friends do.
Fiction. And they don't want to tell anyone. It's like a secret. But
oh, I have friends who don't care.
Yeah.
And people who want to keep it secret.
Yeah.
So there's also a new category of fiction called new adult literature. And I want to mention this because I think our book could actually fall into this instead of young adult literature.
Okay.
But it was coined by St. Martin's Press in 2009. And this is where the main character is over 18 and dealing with becoming an adult, leaving your family, paying bills, taking care, having a real relationship.
Yeah.
By real, I mean not first love.
Yeah, not your puppy love high school thing.
Having a child.
Okay.
Actually, it's funny. 50 Shades of Grey is sometimes coined as new adult literature. Because
she's in college.
She's in college, and she's dealing with growing up and
you would,
dating a billionaire, right?
Dating a billionaire, which you don't normally do at 16. You shouldn't. 16-year-olds
no.
out there.
But in college, it's fine.
Yeah.
Totally
yeah.
fine. So that's kind of where the genre is right now. And I wanted to talk also about some of the tropes in YA literature.
Yeah. Because there are things that occur. There are some themes.
Right. It can be any kind of genre. Because YA literature, I saw this on many articles that I read, it's not a genre. It's actually a publishing category for this is who we're marketing
who we're
it towards.
We're throwing this towards,
and then
yeah.
the new adult fiction is also, we're marketing it towards these people. It's not a genre. So it can be fantasy. It can
yeah.
be dystopian. It can be sci-fi. It can be romance. It
yeah.
can be just everyday fiction.
Yeah.
I say everyday fiction. That's so boring.
Yeah.
Not,
who cares?
No, it's
I
not.
Need shapeshifters and vampires.
I want fantasy. Yeah.
Urban fantasy. Yeah.
So, and the thing about young adult literature is it has a very simple voice and tone to it, kind of to strip down
yeah,
all the fuss around.
Yeah. Like, you don't need to reread sentences.
No, you don't. And the story comes fast. It's more about the plot than anything.
Yeah.
And I mean, I love all types of literature, but when you get to some of the more heady stuff, it becomes about the wordplay.
Yeah.
And that can be a little bit distracting. They were talking about YA literature in one article as kind of like an entryway. So if you're reading YA fantasy, then it's easier to read than, say, Lord of the Rings.
It is.
Where you're
it
sitting through the
is.
Whole Council of Elrond.
Yeah.
And you
just
have to learn all this
talking.
Mythology
yeah.
and all these names you don't know, whereas with a YA fantasy book, it's going to go A to B to C.
Not a million characters normally.
Right. And the world will be introduced slowly in a way that makes sense.
Yeah.
Also, all of the issues in young adult literature, whether it be literally life and death or in a locker room where you're getting bullied, are life and death issues. Everything is really intense. But that's teenage life.
Yeah, when you're a teenager, everything is more important. Everything you do just seems more intense, like you said, yeah.
Yeah, if you're getting bullied in the locker room, like it seems like I'm never going to be able to live this down
yeah,
tomorrow.
Yeah, it seems like the end of the world.
Yeah.
And it is terrible.
It is. And YA literature does not shy away from dark issues. Talks about bullying.
Yeah.
Parents leaving you. You know, losing friends, losing loved ones,
yeah.
death.
Having a fight in a Thunderdome arena for your sister.
Yeah.
It's intense.
Dark issues.
Dark issues.
So that's where YA is today and some of the things that go into writing it.
It's such a huge market today, and it's funny to think that it hasn't always been around.
Yeah, it wasn't there until the 1960s.
Like, it started in the 1960s, and it had, like, a heyday in the 70s, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then it declined, and now heyday again. So it's really, yeah. really interesting.
Before the 1960s, if you were a teen, sucks for you.
Sucks for you. Nope, you don't get any books. So I thought this book was really cool, and I'd like to start talking about our opinions, like what we saw and how this book measures up to the fairy tales it came from.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. Especially the fairy tales. I really enjoy Beauty and the Beast. So I'd read the abridged version of the original, kids version.
Yeah, the kids version, the one that most people know.
I had forgotten most of it, and I really enjoy, especially after hearing that, how much of it that Sarah J. Maas took and put into
the book. Yeah, like the influence. And it's easy to say, it's easy for someone to be like, oh, she stole this. But I don't look at it like that, because it's not exactly the same thing as the fairy tale. And it's a cool retelling in kind of a modern way.
Right, and it's a mix.
Of the fairy tale. And it's a mix. It's a mix of a bunch of different stuff.
Didn't you say there was even more in there that you didn't talk about originally?
There is even more. Just the Beauty and the Beast story itself, that kind of archetype of a story, goes back debatably 4,000 years.
So that's not even an original story.
So that's not even an original story. You know, everything has been told. All the stories have been told. And I thought, I didn't love this book. I don't love YA. I love fiction. I love, Tolkien's probably my favorite writer of all time.
Right. You love Harry Potter.
I do love Harry Potter. That's true. I think it just came out at the right time. But so I didn't love this book. But what I did love was reading it and being like, this is from something and this is from something. And kind of doing, going back and seeing like, oh, it's cool that she took this monster from this culture, and this is from old Welsh, you know, paganism, and this is from this.
And even the map in the front of the book.
The map in the book, yeah. For people who haven't read it, the map in the front of the book is very reminiscent of England and Ireland.
Yeah, it's pretty much England.
England and Ireland, and the Ireland island on this map is called Hibern. And the Romans used to call that island Hibernia.
Yeah.
So there's a lot there. One of the things I didn't get to talk about was the story of Cupid and Psyche, which is another story that kind of parallels Beauty and the Beast. It's very similar. And it's in a greater work called The Metamorphosis, or The Golden Ass, written by Apuleius in the 2nd century AD. And one of the funny things is the main character in The Metamorphosis is this guy named Lucius.
Oh, similar to Lucin.
And the best friend, the beast's best friend in A Court of Thorns and Roses is Lucian. And he's a jerk. He's an ass.
Yeah, especially in the beginning of the
book. Especially in the beginning. And he has a golden eye. And in The Metamorphosis, the main character, Lucius, is turned into an ass, a donkey. And the story's called The Golden Ass. So there's like just little, like learning about that, it gave me much respect to Sarah J. Maas.
Yeah, I really enjoyed interviews with her. And it just also because it's like, oh, you're into the stuff I'm into. You're such a nerd as well. Like she talks about loving fantasy and loving these myths. And it, when you like the person who's making the work, it makes you like the work so much more.
Yeah, it makes you like the work more. It makes you appreciate it more. One of the things I wasn't huge on, and it's a young adult trope, I think, is the beast was, he could turn into a beast, but normally he was just a hot elf. He was a normal
fairy.
Hot fairy, whatever. He was a hot fairy in a mask with beautiful green eyes and
toned biceps.
And actually the green eyes thing is mentioned in the legend of the myth of Tamlin.
Oh, okay.
The fairy queen literally says, you know, when Tamlin is taken by the woman, the fairy queen says, I should have plucked out your pretty green eyes before someone took you, or I should have turned your heart to stone. And in the book, Tamlin has a stone heart.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Wow. See, I think it would have been more interesting if he had been a beast the entire time. Just to go back to what you were saying about him being a hot
man.
I don't mind.
Yeah, I know.
We were talking about it earlier. I'm not the biggest fan of just romance.
Yeah.
But you give me a fantasy romance, Like, I can get down with that.
Yeah.
Also, as a younger girl, as a teenager, YA fantasy was just, it was my favorite thing. It was my escape. It was what I read. So when I read something like this, it just is.
It takes you back a little bit.
It takes me back, and it kind of puts me in that happy place where it's like, oh, this is what used to make me feel so good. And
yeah.
It was when I could get out of school and I could go home and I could read this, and it was so much better than anything else I was doing at the time.
Yeah. No, that's what, and that's the point. That's what YA should be, you know, just a fun.
Better than anything else that you're doing at the time.
It's better than anything else. Well, it should be, as a kid, it's like a fun escape, and it opens that door.
Right.
Into other readings.
Right. And hopefully from there you can move on to other classics and.
Yeah, other classics, but. Even so, I think if you're reading something and you're enjoying it, then
that is seriously all that matters. We're talking about friends who are embarrassed about just reading YA. And I understand, but I feel like that's what you like. That's what you like.
Yeah, embrace it.
Yeah, I don't listen to really great, cool music because sometimes I just don't get why it's supposed to be cool.
Yeah, yeah. You're satisfied with Nicki Minaj and whoever.
I love Nicki Minaj. I like pop and... I understand that, it's not cool, but...
Yeah.
And I also think YA is getting cooler, especially with things like Harry Potter and with Hunger Games that have become so popular and everyone reads
them.
Yeah,
and that are good stories. And this is another good story. A Court of Thorns and Roses is a good story.
Yeah, it's a great story.
So that's our show for tonight, guys. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We love listener feedback, so please leave a comment and feel free to contact us. Our website can be found at dsrapodcast.com. I can be found on Twitter at Klex, KLEX303.
I can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Along with Claire.
And you can contact our producer, James, at James Fowey Jr. That's James Fowey, F-O-U-H-E-Y-J-R, on Twitter. Thanks again, guys, and we will see you next time.